Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
We know that the cost in human life, if we're only talking about the unborn, has been mind-boggling. But what about the cost elsewhere to society, to our legal system, to our medical system, to women who engage in this, well, let's just call it what it is, a genocide? What is the cost to all of us to have 50 years of legalized abortion? Joining us to talk about the failure of legalized abortion, Dr. Ryan Anderson. He is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas. He's founder and editor of The Public Discourse and co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solved Nothing. Dr. Anderson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be with you guys.
What challenges will face the pro-life community if Roe is overturned?
Well, I mean, the first challenge, which is also a huge opportunity, is just going to be persuading the American public to vote the right way on abortion regulations, to vote the right way on who we elect to represent us that will then be voting on abortion regulations. I mean, some laws will be decided through direct democracy, where we'll actually have like ballot initiatives protecting unborn babies, protecting their mothers. Some will be delegated to our representatives. There'll be votes in state houses. There'll be votes in Congress. And so one big challenge is going to be persuasion, which is also, you know, what motivated Alexandra and I to write the book was we could count to five. We think the Supreme Court's going to finally admit they got it wrong 49 years ago. And the most likely outcome, therefore, would be returning this to the people, returning it to the people's representatives, making this an issue for democracy. And therefore, we need to be able to make the best arguments we can to people who don't already agree with us. And so the book's really meant to equip readers to be able to have those conversations, to be able to persuade people the truth about unborn life, the truth about how abortion harms everything and solves nothing.
Why have abortion advocates largely switched lately from talking about abortion as a necessary evil, safe, legal, rare, something like that, to promoting it as a positive good?
I mean, I think part of that is a sign of a lack of confidence in their own position. And so they need to take a more extreme position. If abortion is a necessary evil, well, then maybe there are ways to make it less necessary. Maybe the pro-lifers are up to something. They have some aspect of the truth when they say we want to discourage abortion or we want to reduce abortion. But if it's a positive good, then it should be publicly funded. Then every hospital should provide it. Every doctor should perform it. There should be no conscientious exemptions. There should be no religious liberty exemptions. The Little Sisters of the Poor, the owners of Hobby Lobby. I mean, you can see how once you embrace the positive good viewpoint argument, then a lot of the other aspects of the more radical wing of the pro-abortion political agenda starts to make sense.
Talk about how chemical abortion, which has kind of been flying under the radar, even though it's extremely common, how in particular does it have ties to the sex trafficking industry?
And you're exactly right that it has been flying under the radar, and yet it now accounts for nearly half of all abortions. And unfortunately, what's taken place in many jurisdictions as a result of the COVID pandemic was that various jurisdictions, both in the UK and in the United States, eliminated any requirement for an in-person diagnostic visit, allowing the abortion pill to be prescribed via telemedicine and to then be self-administered at home, so that at no point, either when prescribing the pill or when taking the abortion pill, is the mother seen by a medical professional. And what this allows is greater ease for sex traffickers to have women who become pregnant in the course of being prostituted by the sex trafficker, and then not have that woman have a way of reaching out for help. If you have to go to an in-person clinic, you can either explicitly say, I'm being held against my will, please help. Or many nurses and other health professionals are actually trained on how to read the signs, right? How to read implicit signs that someone is being held under duress, that someone needs assistance, and they can intervene. And those opportunities are lost when you have chemical abortion, especially when it's done via telemedicine and administered at home.
What has the Roe decision done to the rule of law in the United States?
Well, I mean, it's directly undermined it. There's nothing in our Constitution that actually protects lethal violence in the womb. I mean, 49 years ago, what we had was we had unelected justices simply impose their own personal beliefs about abortion on the entire nation. And that's not how the rule of law works. We have higher law and we have lower law. We have natural law and we have positive law. And properly understood, man-made law should square with the natural law. Normal regulations and normal statutes should be in accordance with the Constitution, right? So constitutional law trumps statutory law. And here we just had justices claim that the Constitution requires their preferred regulatory scheme on abortion, with Roe, a trimester scheme, with Casey, an undue burden scheme at viability, et cetera, et cetera. And so this means that for the past 50 years, it was first seven people and then five people who got to make abortion policy in the country. And then as a result, you can see how it's turned confirmation hearings into political circuses, how every election, you know, a major driving issue for many citizens is the question of abortion. And so it's undermined a proper understanding of how the rule of law would operate. And so, you know, we have a chapter dedicated in the book just to the constitutional questions, and then another chapter dedicated to more of the political questions, how it undermines democratic self-government.
How has the medical profession been corrupted by abortion advocacy?
Yeah, so I guess it's chapter four that focuses on the medical profession and a variety of things to say there. I mean, you could start the list with the various lies that have been told by medical doctors, whether it's about the medical necessity of abortion, whether it's about denying the humanity of the unborn, pretending that we don't actually know what the creature in the womb is, pretending it's just a clump of cells, pretending it's not really a human being. And this isn't the medical profession writ large. It tends to be self-selected medical experts, right? So many of our listeners would be familiar about this from the transgender context, where you have self-selected trans health experts, the gender experts who make the guidelines for gender medicine. And then we see puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, et cetera, et cetera. Something similar has taken place with abortion, where you have self-proclaimed reproductive health experts saying that women need abortion, that the unborn baby is not really a baby, not really a person, not really someone with moral status. And then you see various further corruptions where they refuse to acknowledge realities of physical, emotional, and psychological harms of abortion, either immediate physical complications of abortion, whether surgical abortion or the abortion pill, long-term physical complications, and with respect to things like a much elevated risk for breast cancer, a much elevated risk for preterm birth, harder for future pregnancies to go full term after you've had an abortion, and then the reality of abortion regret, various psychological trauma after abortion, particularly chemical abortion, which is self-induced. Chemical abortion where the mother passes the now dead child. These things can be traumatic, and many people within the medical profession have to deny any of these complications in order to prop up their support for abortion. And then the last thing I'll mention is that it doesn't stay contained to the abortion issue. And what I mean by that is the logic of abortion has been extended to physician-assisted suicide. It's been extended to embryo-destructive research, cloning, embryo-destructive research and cloning in particular for stem cells, that once you say the unborn child in the womb isn't really a human being, isn't really a human person, doesn't really have moral status, well, then what about the embryo in the lab? And what about the creation of embryos precisely to then harvest them for their stem cells? And what about grandma when grandma loses her memory and she would, quote, be better off dead? And so you can see the corruption of the medical a profession where we allow tools that are meant for healing to now be used for killing. And we tell, you know, the chapter four, I think, is a really important chapter because it just goes through the variety of ways in which abortion has harmed the medical community.
You mentioned this a moment ago, but let's talk about our democratic process and how it has been distorted over the last 50 years by legalized abortion.
Pro-life Democrats were once a thing. Now they're an endangered species. Catholic Democrats, who were actually meaningfully Catholic, were once a thing. Now we have the scandal of people like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi claiming to be faithful, devout Catholics, while also refusing to condemn attacks on pregnancy resource centers, refusing to condemn the violence that has come out of the group Jane's Revenge. But this has corrupted our democratic process because so many citizens lack a meaningful political choice because one political party is fundamentally committed to a human rights violation. And therefore, many pro-life citizens feel that they're captive to the other political party who they may not agree with on other issues, right? They may not agree with the economic agenda or the foreign policy agenda of the pro-life party, but we only have one pro-life party. So wouldn't our form of self-government be better if both of our political parties were committed to at least basic human rights? And then the political choices we had was, you know, whose economic agenda is better? Whose foreign policy agenda is better? But at least both political parties are morally acceptable. No one is committed to a fundamental injustice. And unfortunately, we now have, particularly over the past 20 years, radicalized one political party where they went after the few remaining pro-life Democrats and kicked them out of the party. They primaried them. I'm thinking of someone like Dan Lipinski, a pro-life Catholic Democrat who was meaningfully pro-life. And so the Democrats primaried him. This is a problem because it then leaves people without a meaningful political choice.
We're talking with Dr. Ryan Anderson about the failure of legalized abortion. He's co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. When we come back, since he mentions justice, what's the dirty little secret regarding abortion and racial minorities? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
From the time of Moses, 3,500 years ago, the church has been adorning her sacred spaces at the instruction of the Lord. Ad Crucem seeks to continue this tradition to the best of our ability as we create beautiful things to point us to Christ crucified for sinners. See our posters, greeting cards, artwork, and banners, each proclaiming the good work that our Lord has done for us. Visit adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming 3-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Memoria Press exists to promote and impart the classical heritage of the Christian West through an emphasis on the liberal arts and the great works of the Western tradition. The Memoria Press curriculum encourages the development of wisdom and virtue through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR22. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com. You can't copy the murder and call the lady. Everywhere you look now, murder and call the lady.
Well, Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the failure of legalized abortion. Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, founder and editor of The Public Discourse, and co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solved Nothing. Before the break, you were talking about justice. In that vein, what is the dirty little secret regarding abortion and racial minorities?
Sure, this is just really tragic, but in New York City, for example, more Black babies are aborted than they are born. There's a eugenic history to Planned Parenthood. The founder, Margaret Sanger, this was back when before abortion and contraception was the main issue. But, you know, there was a eugenicist aspect to this in two senses. They wanted more babies from the intellectually fit. So a lot of the contraceptive push was to have more babies from the fit and fewer babies from the unfit. But also not just in terms of intellectual capacity, also in terms of the proper ethnic heritage, the proper skin color. And that what took originally took place through contraception was then extended through abortion. We cite Ryan Bomberger, founder of a pro-life group, who I forget the exact statistic right now, but it's a ridiculously high number. I don't even want to guesstimate what it is, of Planned Parenthoods are located in predominantly Black neighborhoods. It's not so much that they target under a racist guise, but they perpetuate a system in which Black women think that they need abortion at these elevated rates. And in any other circumstance, if we saw a substantial portion of Black Americans being killed or being denied adequate health care, we wouldn't say, all right, well, we have to increase the supply of the killing. We would say we have to get to the root cause, right? And whether it's greater access to healthcare for Black mothers, whether it's greater access to employment for Black fathers, whether it's greater support for the unborn babies, that's what our response should be. And so we have a chapter where we look at sex discriminatory abortion, racial discriminatory abortion, and then also physical disability, children diagnosed with physical and mental disabilities. And what we point out is that voices on the political spectrum, normally progressive left voices, who are the loudest to condemn racial discrimination, sex-based discrimination, and disability-based discrimination in every other context, are silent when it comes to lethal discrimination in the womb. It's a huge problem.
Some have kind of preposterously claimed that abortion plays a positive role by eliminating conditions like Down syndrome. How do you respond to that, Ryan?
I would invite people to get to know George Will's son. And we quote, I mean, it's several paragraphs. It might take up a full page in the book. We quote an op-ed that George Will wrote for the Washington Post maybe a decade ago. And I think it was his son's 40th birthday. And his son was born, I believe it was the year before Roe. So it was 1972. Maybe it was 1971. And so this would have been 2011 when the son turns 40 and George writes an op-ed about what a joy his son is and what a fulfilling life his son has. And while his son will never write a book or a newspaper column the way George does, his son has simpler, more profound joys. And he talks about this year, my son's birthday, he'll be doing what he does every year on his birthday. He'll be at the National Park, the Washington, D.C. baseball team, and he'll be sitting there with a beer in his hand. And then he says he'll be an equal in the Republic of Baseball. And he'll be enjoying a baseball game with a beer. And our point is people with Down syndrome, people with other developmental disabilities, they are our equals, not just at the ballpark, but everywhere else in life. And a culture that respected that would not be seeking to eliminate their lives in the womb. I hate it whenever I see the headlines that say something like Iceland eliminates Down syndrome, as if they found a cure for Down syndrome. What they did was they eliminated all of the people with Down syndrome in the womb.
Does America's current legal permissiveness regarding abortion, does it line up with public opinion?
Not at all, which is why I think many of the pro-abortion activists are very concerned that if we get rid of Roe and we return the abortion question to the democratic branches of government, and if we have the people have a say in what our abortion laws should look like, we're going to get much more protective laws than what we currently have. And so let me just give you an example. The Mississippi law that is at the Supreme Court, the Dobbs case, that's a ban on abortion after 15 weeks. I forget the exact statistic. We cite it in the book, but it's something like 42 out of the 47 European countries have laws that are more protective of unborn babies and of mothers than the Mississippi law. And Europeans aren't, you know, particularly more conservative than Americans. And so pro-abortion people see this and they say, if we give Americans the choice of which laws to make, they're going to make laws that are much more protective. We're going to have heartbeat bills. We might have fetal pain bills. We might have conception bills. And they don't like that. When you look at public opinion on abortion, a lot is contingent on how the question is worded. So a lot really hinges on how they phrase the question. But the American people are not in favor of abortion on demand up through and including the moment of birth. Nor are they okay with taxpayer funding of abortion. Both of those things, abortion on demand up through and including the moment of birth with taxpayer funding, are the official platform of the Democratic Party.
So how do you explain the doubling down that the Democratic Party has been doing on those very issues, late-term abortion, taxpayer funding of abortion? They have radicalized their position on that. Why?
I think part of this is capture of both political parties by the activists. Some of this goes back to reforms that were made after the 1968 election with the primary process. So this is me putting on my nerd hat from graduate school. I have a PhD in political science, and you're just thinking through some of that now long forgotten history on you know, my part, long forgotten. But there were changes that were made into how the primary selected candidates. But even I think apart from those changes, you just see a greater role for the special interest groups, a greater role for various activist groups. And then you have a younger generation of elected officials who themselves are radicalized. So think about the squad within the Democratic Party. And then you have an older generation trying to keep up. Right. So I think Pelosi, Biden, and others have actually embraced much more radical positions than what they once held. Biden was once, he identified himself as pro-life. A variety of Democratic officials were once pro-life and then over time became pro-choice. And then they had a moderate pro-choice position. And now they become more pro-abortion. And it's partly in response to the activists. It's partly what they need to do to get elected during the primary process.
You say that abortion advocates are not pro-choice. What do you mean by that, Ron?
So, you know, we wrote this book a few months ago, and we would just point out to the ways in which activists would target pregnancy resource centers for additional legal scrutiny, for new regulations. In California, they were trying to make the pro-life pregnancy resource centers advertise for the nearest abortion clinics. Now we can just point to how many different crisis pregnancy centers, pro-life pregnancy resource centers, have been vandalized in the past several weeks since Alito's opinion in Dobbs was leaked. How many of these centers have been firebombed? How many have been hit with graffiti? If you were pro-choice, you would have no objection to a clinic that exists simply to have its doors open for women who voluntarily walk through those doors asking for help. Women who make a choice for life. All pregnancy resource centers do is say, we are here to help you if you choose to come to us, and if you choose to come to us because you're choosing life for your child. Why would that be objectionable? Why would those clinics be the ones being targeted by the group Jane's Revenge? It reveals something about what the activists are really in favor of. The second thing I'll say is that I think it's poor rhetoric to say pro-choice if you don't then fill in the blank. Pro-choice on what? Right. And this goes back to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, right? Someone like Stephen Douglas who's like, look, I'm not in favor of slavery. I just think you should have the choice to own a slave. No, that means you are pro-slavery, right? You think slavery is the type of issue that should be left up to individual choice, right? And, you know, we don't say that about other issues. We don't say, you know, I'm pro-choice on adult homicide, right? We rightfully say, no, you can't kill an adult. And I think we should also rightfully say you can't kill a child. And just say, well, look, I'm in favor of choice doesn't specify, well, which choice is it that you're actually supporting?
Dr. Ryan Anderson is our guest. We're talking about the failure of legalized abortion. He's co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. We'll get the biological, moral, and political case for protecting the unborn after this.
What you like, I call it love. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
The images of the war in Ukraine that have filled our screens over the last few months have left many people wondering, how do we address this as Lutherans? How do we think about war? How does the church, or can the church, speak to the state at such a time? Well, if you've asked such questions, you need to pick up the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness. There we ask and answer these very questions. To find out more, visit cph.org/witness or our website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Oh, unborn child, if you only knew just what your mama was planning to do.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the failure of legalized abortion on this Monday, June the 20th. Our guest is Dr. Ryan Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Dr. Anderson, you make the case biological, moral, and political for protecting the unborn. Begin, if you would, with the biological case.
Sure. So what we point out in the very first chapter is on the harms of abortion to the unborn. Because, you know, the book kind of goes systematically chapter by chapter on how abortion harms everything it touches. And obviously the primary harm is the harm to the child because it kills the child, right? And that's the focal case, the focal argument is that abortion kills the baby. And what we point out is we say, look, that basic argument rests on three theses: a biological argument about when human life begins, a moral argument about the intrinsic value of every human life, and then a political argument about the state, at the very least, protecting citizens from unjust violence, right? From lethal violence against the innocent. And so the biological thesis is pretty straightforward. The life of a new human being begins at the completion of fertilization. That sperm and egg are both functionally and genetically parts of the parents. But when a new zygote comes into existence, that single cell embryo, it's neither functionally nor genetically a part of the mother nor a part of the father. It's a new, distinct, complete human being that will now develop him or herself, because sex is determined at conception, that organism will lead, you know, a self-directed process of development, maturation, growth, so that the embryo will become a blastocyst, become a fetus, become a newborn, become an infant, become a toddler, become a teenager, become a radio show host. And that entire trajectory, I didn't just name a dozen different organisms, I just named a dozen different stages of development of one and the same organism. A dozen different stages of development are a dozen different ages of the same human being, right? So that you could say, I was once a teenager, was once a child, was once a toddler, was once an infant, was once a newborn, was once a fetus, was once an embryo, was once a zygote. And that's where it stops. I was never once a sperm or once an egg. But once the zygote came into being, that's when I came into being. So that's the first thesis, is a thesis about when human beings begin. And then the second is a moral argument. Each and every human being has intrinsic worth and dignity, and therefore each and every human being has a right to life, because each and every one of us has duties not to kill another human being. We have duties to assist the flourishing of human beings. If we're the parents of the child, we have duties to nurture that child, to care for that child. Or if we can't fulfill those duties ourselves, to find someone else who can, right? So many parents heroically choose adoption precisely because they did the part that they could. They brought the child into the world. They couldn't fulfill the next a duty that they have, the upbringing. So they place the child for adoption. This is what underlies the claim of our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. And amongst these is the right to life, right? That's the moral case. Each and every one of us is created equal, and we're endowed by our creator with a right to life. That's a truth of, you could think of that philosophical theology. Revealed theology tells us each and every one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. And that image and that likeness commences when we commence, right? From the very first moment of our conception, that zygote is made in the image and likeness of God. You know, the newborn, the toddler, you don't have to wait for them to be able to talk or to have higher brain functions, right? This is where you sometimes, we address all of the Peter Singer style personhood arguments that say it's speciesist. Like racism, you could have speciesism to treat humans better than you treat other species. We point out, well, no, the human creature, the human species is a personal species because we have these personal attributes that are part of our nature, even if we can't yet exercise them. This is why we know that one day the unborn child will speak if all goes well, but we know our dog will never speak. And so a teenager who can't speak, we say, suffers a disability, because there's an ability that's there, but something is preventing him from exercising it. The dog that can't talk, we don't say that dog is disabled, because he never had the ability to begin with. His nature doesn't have that ability. And so there's something special, unique about the human species, that we're made in the image and likeness of God. That's a theological way of saying it. Philosophically, you can say we have a personal nature, right? So that's the moral argument. And then I'll just wrap this up. The political argument is that government exists at the very least to protect innocent human beings from lethal violence. Right? I think you should have a more capacious, extensive understanding of the role of government, but at the very least, the role of government is to protect us from unjust violence. And so it's not an overstep of the state to prohibit abortion and to protect unborn children. It's no more an imposition of morality, or, you know, you're legislating morality, you're imposing your religion. It's no more and no less of an imposition than laws that ban adult homicide, right? So laws that ban fetal homicide, they impose morality to the same extent that laws that ban adult homicide. They legislate religion to the same extent. And so if the secularist doesn't have a good reason for why we should ban adult homicide, so much the worse for secularism.
You say that the personally opposed position, the one that is adopted by our president, Joe Biden, where he says he personally opposes abortion, but he can't impose that on anyone else. You say that position is incoherent. How so?
Well, it's incoherent in the following way. What is your reason for being personally opposed to abortion? Right. If you clearly understand why you're personally opposed to abortion, it's not like someone who's personally opposed to eating broccoli because they don't think broccoli tastes good, or they're personally opposed to fill in the blank because, you know, it doesn't work for them. Right. The reason someone should be personally opposed to abortion is because it's an injustice. It's a violation of the duties that we have, the obligations that we have to unborn babies. And so you can't just be personally opposed to abortion. That would be like saying, I'm personally opposed to slavery, but I think you should have the right to own a slave, right? Don't like slavery, don't own a slave. You sometimes hear people say, don't like an abortion, don't have an abortion. Well, it's not a matter of liking it. It is if, you know, some people like chocolate, some people like vanilla, some people like abortion, some people don't like abortion. For those who are personally opposed to abortion, if they really understand why, they would have to see that they should be publicly opposed as well, because abortion is an injustice. That's why it's incoherent to say I'm personally opposed, but, right? Everything that follows that but shows that you're not really all that personally opposed.
We're talking with Dr. Ryan Anderson, co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. When we return, he talks about a last-ditch argument for abortion. We'll find out what it sounds like.
The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
I paid for the murder before they determine the sex. Choosing our life over your life meant your death. And you never got a chance to even open your eyes. Sometimes I wonder as a fetus, if you fought for your life, would you have been a little genius in love with
Dr.
Math?
Ryan Anderson is our guest. The failure of legalized abortion is our topic. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues, Etc. Through the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry, the body of Christ comes together to value all human life from conception to natural death. LCMS Life Ministry speaks up for life, cares for people in body and soul, and teaches about the sanctity of human life. Check out their free pro-life resources at lcms.org/life. Advocating, educating, and caring for all human life, lcms.org/life. Dr. Anderson, you talk about the last-ditch argument for abortion. What is it?
Yeah, this is the argument that flows in the most rigorous academic way from the philosopher Judith Jarvis Thompson. And so at the end of our first chapter, we say, look, there's the biological thesis about when human beings begin, the moral thesis about basic equality and the intrinsic worth and dignity, political argument, the role of the state in protecting human beings from lethal violence. And those three theses are pretty hard to persuasively combat if you're, you know, debating someone who knows the arguments. And so this last ditch argument is, like, all right, fine. I agree with you. It's a human being. It has moral status. The role of the state is to protect us from lethal violence. But there's another consideration here. Women have autonomy over their bodies. Women never consented to have a trespasser live inside of their womb for 9 months. And so the analogy that philosopher Judith Jarvis Thompson used is, if you go to sleep at night and you leave your window open, and while you're sleeping, someone trespasses in your house and connects you to a patient that needs to be connected to you for 9 months, you know, needs to make use of your liver, your kidneys, whatever. And then 9 months from now, that person will be healed and they can disconnect. The argument is that, look, that's a violation of your bodily autonomy. That's a violation of your bodily integrity. You can disconnect. Therefore, you should be able to disconnect from the baby. And we spend several pages responding to this because it's a particularly bad argument. And one of the things we point out is the vast majority of abortions aren't just about disconnecting from the unborn child. They're about killing the unborn child. An abortion in which the unborn child lives is considered a failed abortion. The intentionality, the goal, the objective of the abortionist isn't just to separate the baby from the mother. It's to ensure that the baby is dead. So that's point one. Point two, unlike if, you know, you and I were to go to sleep tonight with the window open and someone were to trespass, the baby is not a trespasser, right? The baby is exactly where the baby should be. The baby is doing exactly what the baby ought to be doing. The baby is where we once were and doing what we once did. This is exactly how every human being enters the world, is inside of their mother's womb. And so the baby's not a trespasser, the baby's not a parasite. Furthermore, in 99% of pregnancies that end in abortion, the mother and the father consented to the sexual act that created the child, which is to say that, unlike, you know, leaving a window open and somehow, you know, someone came into my house and hooked up to my body, in this case, the mother and the father voluntarily performed the action that created the new life. And so that then highlights a fourth argument, which is that parents have special obligations to their children. Right? So it's not just that strangers shouldn't kill each other, but parents shouldn't kill their children. Parents have duties, obligations, responsibilities towards their children.
So bottom line here, we obviously know what the abortion does to the unborn child, and that it's in itself is tragic, but there's tragedy upon tragedy here. What do we know about the effect of abortion on women?
Enough to fill, you know, an entire chapter of the book. So the second chapter of Tearing Us Apart is how abortion harms women. And we look at this from a couple of different angles. We look at immediate physical harms to women, the complications from surgical abortions, complications, it's 2 to 3 times higher rates of complications with chemical abortions, particularly when chemical abortions are prescribed via telemedicine and when they are self-medicated, taken at home alone. So there are immediate physical complications. There are also long-term physical complications, an elevated risk of breast cancer. And we explain why abortion leads to the elevated risk of breast cancer, elevated risk of preterm birth for future pregnancies. And we explain why as well, that, you know, if you don't carry that pregnancy to term, you abort the baby, it makes your body less likely to carry future pregnancies all the way to term. So there's lower birth weight, greater risk of preterm birth. We also point out some of the psychological consequences. All of the best studies that we have show that women who have abortions are at elevated risks for regret, for psychological complications like depression, like anxiety as a result of the abortion. But then one last thing we do is we point out how abortion as a cultural matter has harmed women, that the cultural message of abortion is your body, your choice, meaning if you choose to keep the baby, you're on your own because you could have chosen to abort the baby. And so if it's her body, her choice, that means it's also her responsibility if she chooses life. We also show how the logic of abortion has allowed men to use and discard women as objects of sexual gratification. The abortion is what has fueled the sexual revolution, the hookup culture, non-marital sex. And then lastly, it's built a culture in which women are told to be equal to men, they have to sterilize their bodies. That their body given by nature is somehow defective. And so they need contraception and abortion to be able to behave as if they had a male body. So to compete in the economy, to compete in education, to compete in our culture, they have to change their bodily nature. So rather than saying there are two equally human ways of being human, a male way and a female way, and then structuring our economy, our education system, our culture around both ways of being human and taking the female way of being human seriously, what we've said is that for women to be equal to men, they need to compete as if men, meaning that they are unattached to babies. We cite my colleague at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, the legal scholar Erica Bakiaki, a law review article she wrote and then a book where she wrote, describing what she calls the asymmetrical nature of human reproduction, which is simply to say that men and women play an asymmetrical role in reproduction. And we should take that seriously and then structure our laws, our public policies, our culture, our economy around those embodied realities. What abortion has done instead is told women, you're going to be equal, but that means you're going to have to deny your own bodily nature.
Dr. Ryan Anderson is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's the John Paul II Teaching Fellow in Social Thought at the University of Dallas, founder and editor of The Public Discourse, and co-author of the new book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Anderson, thank you again.
Thank you.
Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Victor David Hansen about the restoration of citizenship. We'll discuss Rick Warren playing the missional card at the annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention. Our guest will be Chris Roseborough, and we'll visit with Pastor Eric Eichinger, author of the book of the month, Lord of Legends, Jesus Redemption Quest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep.
scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.